heard something with a comment. Try again.
Why is the other person?
Okay, yeah. Hal, there's a lot of a buzzing sound on your signal, like you're off frequency or something funny going on. But go ahead and make your comment, Hal. We can hear it, just I'm letting you know there's a little bit of a funny sound. You got it, Hal.
Okay, very good, Dick. Yeah, a very easy way of finding out what an antenna tuner will do as far as the impedance range goes. If you have an antenna analyzer, an MFJ antenna analyzer, put it into the antenna tuner at a specific frequency you want to see what it will handle. Take a 1500 ohm carbon pot, put it on the other end of the tuner. Set the pot first to 1500 ohms, see if you could get the tuner to balance out one-to-one on the analyzer. Then drop it down to 1200 ohms. Take the pot off, measure the resistance, put it back on. You could then see the full range of the antenna tuner. You bring the pot all the way to, say, 30 ohms. If you could still get your analyzer to null out, you could right away see what the full range of the impedance capability is of your antenna tuner. That's my comment, Dick.
That's very clever. It's quite clever, but there's a limit. And a man's got to know his limitations, Hal and Alan. That's good for the resistive component only. If the resistive component is mounted directly at the output end of the tuner. If I did that exact same experiment on the far end of my transmission line, assuming my transmission line is 50 ohms and assuming my transmission line is lossless, I'm using a piece of 1 5/8 Andrew Heliax, which at 30 megacycles and below has only got a tenth of a dB of loss or less, and if I did that exact same resistive experiment, I would get an entirely different set of answers, because that resistor on the far end of that transmission line gets rotated by the Smith chart into some other reactive component. So the simple experiment of putting the pot on the end of the antenna tuner is drawing a straight line across, a straight horizontal line across the Smith chart. And you're finding out how much resistive component it can handle. To get into those positive and negative reactive components up and down on the Smith chart, you've now got to either put in real reactances or do it through a transmission line. There's a little bit more to it, and it's a good beginning, just letting you know there's more to the story. It's never quite as simple as we'd like. Mel wanted to make a comment. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Hey, I took the words right out of my mouth. Exactly. That's why that experiment, I went through that with the Smith chart, and I showed the fallacy of that, and then I showed you another method by putting a 25 ohm resistor in, and so to read, I could say, determine the plus or minus J factor. However, in his case of what kind, what he wants to do, an inverted L works quite well. An inverted L is an inverted L type tuner. Conventional tuners don't work so well. If you look up a number of the inverted the L type tuners, and you have put down a sufficient number of radios, a couple dozen radios in all, and use that inverted L configuration, it will work quite well, Dick. But in experimenting with inverted Ls, I found that was the only way to go, is to build a homebrew tuner using a rotary inductor and a tuning capacitor, variable capacitor in an inverted L type of for an inverted L antenna, in an L network, actually, I should say. And then putting down, if you have a sufficient number of radios, you do need that counterpoise radio, it will work terrific, Dick, over.
K6DBZ with another comment.
Radios on an inverted L?
Yeah, there's a yes and a no to that. When it comes to antenna experiments, you can't build a bad one. Yes, at first, the impedance is going to be hard to match. You don't like it. But the antenna doesn't catch on fire. It doesn't explode. If your transmitter, modern-day transmitter, has enough protection device, you don't get into any real trouble. The antenna doesn't have to be perfect at first. And even if it doesn't work perfectly at first, you make some measurements. You find out what impedance it's got, what impedance you're going to correct, and so on. If your antenna is a balanced structure, one wire going up a tree to the right, the other wire going up some other structure over the roof of the house to the left, you don't need counterpoised radials, and it did sound like you were making a balanced-like antenna. If you're making an antenna that's an L-fed, ZEP-like thing, end-fed antenna, one single wire, to be high in efficiency, you might need some ground plane radials. But with a balanced antenna, you don't. Hal, in fact, Hal's the next person on the list. So, Hal, make your comment, and then start with your question. K6DPZ, what's going on over there in Richmond Hill? K2LAW in the TechNet.
K2LAW in the TechNet, K6DPZ. Okay, first off, I want to say hi to everybody on the net. My method I mentioned to you, number one, is to check an antenna tuner to see what its impedance range is, be it capacitive or inductive reactive, just the output impedance range the tuner will handle. Granted, you add coax, you go to the other end, you're going to have other factors that enter in the equation. I'm just saying to check basically the tuner, what the impedance capability of the tuner is at a given frequency. So I want to get that done first. Number two, I just wanted to say that with a lot of experimentation going on, there's a new repeater about 2 meters. It's an AM repeater. So anybody in the attic, on 145, and all light marked, everybody is K6DPC. And it's called the Dinosaur Repeater.
And once again, Hal, the Dinosaur Repeater is on 145 dot what?
What? Goes out on 146 even.
Okay, I think you said 146. I think you said 146 even. Is that true, Hal? As you can tell, somebody is having some fun with us.
Yeah, 145 in, Dick, 146 out, even for...
Okay, that's how we got it. 145 out, 146 in, the Dinosaur Repeater. Out of curiosity, Hal, where is it located?
First, Dick, 5. It's out. It's about 120 power.
Okay, the people who are closer to Hal, who could hear him on the input, could you repeat the message he just said?
It's 145 in, Dick. 145 in. 146 out.
Very fine, John. And John, where is it located?
Come back.
Dick, it's low. The bandwidth is on a 130.
Okay, I heard you say the word bandwidth, and I heard 130. Want to try it again?
It's on a commercial tower 130 feet up approximately, and it's in Queens.
Very fine. In Queens, 130 feet up, close to the Van Wyck Expressway, is what I think you're saying. Dinosaur repeater. Beautiful. 145 in, 146 out. How long has that been in operation? And it's an AM repeater. Unusual. How'd you find out about that one, Hal? Go ahead.
Well, I put it up. That's how I found out about it. It's been up for over almost a month now.
Fantastic. I bet you've got a good relationship with the repeater owner. How many watts does it run, Hal, and what kind of sensitivity has it got? In other words, from your point of view, it has what kind of coverage around New York City? And by the way, since it's an AM repeater, many of our mobile rigs do not have AM built into them anymore. Since it's an AM repeater, I'm guessing it might not repeat sideband very well. So, how many of the rigs are you familiar with that have got AM that can talk to this repeater? Over to you, Hal.
Okay, well, AM rigs, FT100, 706 Mark II series, TS 2000 has AM, the 746 base unit has AM, then any of the old equipment that's out there that's AM will work. Go ahead, Dick.
Okay, that's good to know. I've got a very old piece of equipment that I really love here. This thing called a Kenwood TS711A. And I'm looking at its dial of all of its modes of operation, FM and sideband and CW. I don't have AM on this rig. I think my older rig, my Kenwood 700, does have AM. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it does have AM. And so, so those other rigs that you mentioned do have. So a certain percentage, what percentage of the rigs that people use as mobiles today, from your point of view, Hal, have AM? And the next question is, from your experience, your dinosaur repeater, as you call it, has what percentage of coverage of the tri-state area? You got it, Hal.
Okay, Dick. Well, it was worked from Staten Island, was heard out to Huntington. Right now it's running about 10 watts carrier, 40 watts peak on AM. The power level is going to be increased. Sensitivity is about half microvolt for 10 dB signal to noise. But the power is going to be increased. I didn't want to bring it up to a power level until I ran some tests. It's running off of two separate antennas, both at about the 120, 130 foot level, 6 dB omnidirectional antennas on the tower.
Very nice. I am curious what motivated this, Al. It's an unusual experiment. Most people, when it comes to mobile repeater, 2-meter operation, think strictly in FM operation, and a few, very few of those people have done some experimenting with sideband or so-called linear repeater. Yours is not a linear translator. Yours is not a linear translator. I have the impression it really does AM envelope demodulation on reception and then envelope restoration amplitude modulation on transmission. That's my guess, although maybe do something a little bit more elaborate with the IF strip. But what was the motivation for this, Al? Unusual. K6DPZ, K2LIW on TechNet.
K2LIW, K6DPZ. Well, the motivation is there's a lot of AM equipment out there, that's on eBay and so on and so forth, that's very cheap and available. There was an AM repeater between 1957 and 1962 out in California that was put up by R. Gentry, K6MYK. And I figured, why not come back and put an AM repeater up again and use some of this old equipment that's available? And being that some people have AM gear and they don't know a place to meet or even you'll get on and then go simplex somewhere else, this is a meeting place. And as far as it goes, it's totally open. No, you don't need any PL to get into it. And it's unique in its design. We're going to use a 1950s technology in the whole control unit. And it uses a $4 keychain voice unit for voice ID. So that's the story to start with, Dick. Go ahead.
And it works.
Fantastic. Since you're using frequencies that ordinarily are not being used, 145.000 on the input, 146.00 on the output, ordinarily not used, I am guessing this kind of extremely unusual repeater requires no repeater coordination by TSOC or any other organization. I'm making a guess on that one. Is that approximately true, Al? Go ahead.
No, it should require coordination. I spent 3 months monitoring these frequencies before something was put on. There was no activity on these frequencies. Plus, it's not broadcast quality AM. The repeater, a lot of it was built from aviation type equipment, aviation base station, with a frequency response of 303,000. So it's not wide. It's very narrow. It also has a very narrow receiver. You have to be within about 6 KCs to get in. If you're off beyond 6 KCs, you're not even going to capture the receiver, Dick.
Okay, there you go. Eric recognized, and I think I heard Doug, the B2SAY, coming in on the eastern input. Let me pick up Eric first, and I'm going to pick up Doug in that area, in that order. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, the reality is coordination really should be there, but, you know, New York is a questionable area because of the organization that runs it. But as long as the people who are on the input make sure that there's 6 kilohertz or less, there shouldn't be a problem in the world. 145.01 is a national packet frequency. It's not used often, but it is used as part of a backbone. So the only caveat here is that you, as a station operator, you really want to keep your stuff under 6 kilohertz, and nobody in the world is going to complain about anything. Back to you, Dick.
fascinating. Very good. Doug, W-H-U-S-A-Y, for Redhead Radio comment. And we have to wait a little longer for the drop to make all this work right. You got it, Doug.
Thank you.
ahead, Doug. Main band switch on the Kenwood 700 does move in 1 megacycle steps. So by flipping back and forth that band switch between transmit and receive, that's a fairly simple implementation of this, what's it called now, dinosaur repeater, as Hal calls it. I would do recommend that you double check your frequency, Doug. The sound that we're hearing sounds like you could be a little bit off the 975-375 combination. We're hearing a little bit of static in the background, and you could be off frequency. And where you're using a rig with a VFO, that's fairly easy to do. Make another transmission. Let's see if we got you back on frequency, Doug. WA2SAY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
WA2SAY, see if it sounds better now.
It does sound quite a bit better. Not perfect, but... I'm going to call it 8 dB better, if you know what I mean. A lot less static and a little bit clearer audio. So I think you're closer to the center of the channel. Okay, the next person on our list was Paul.
Don't move on yet, Dick.
Go ahead, Alan.
Hal was just mentioning the use of a receiver and something to do with the IF. I was wondering if you could just finish what he was going to say. That sounded interesting.
You got it, Hal.
Okay, Dick, very good. Yeah, what you could do is use a regular transistor radio, tune it 1 megacycle, and pick it up off the IF of the transceiver. And you should be able to move up 1 meg and listen, even if you're transmitting on the other side.
Okay, I'm going to reword what I think Hal just said. If the rig is set so that it properly transmits, and when you receive, your rig gives you a normal, let's say, 600 kc offset, and you're looking for another 400 kc of offset to make the 1 meg offset. The earlier stages of the receiver, in most cases, are quite broadband. If you built yourself a tap point on the IF strip of the early stages of the receiver and brought that into an AM radio, say, for instance, an AM radio that goes from the half megacycle to 1.5 megacycles, quite possibly that IF strip, if I understand correctly, will allow you to tune by way of a tap into the IF strip, maybe a 6 picofarad ceramic capacitor, so to speak, coming out to a port on the back port, on the back panel of the rig, then going into your AM radio, would allow you to do this offset receiving. That's what I think Hal is saying. He gave it to us in very brief words. Let me turn it over to Hal for amplification. K6DPZ. Wait for the beep. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW in TechNet. K6DPZ. That's what I was meaning. It's just taking off 1 megacycle difference, and you'll be able to get it. You get an AM. There's a couple different ways of doing it. And also, 1 meg is very easy. If somebody wants to construct an AM transceiver, it could be done very easily, because a 1 meg IF could be a transistor radio. You have to build up an RF section to generate 145. That section at low power can be a mixer for the input at 146. Go ahead, Dick.
You've got a rather unique setup here as far as the East Coast is concerned. If I understand correctly, Hal, experiments like this have been done some number of years ago on the West Coast. But on the East Coast, this is a relatively unique experiment. I wonder if you're planning a series of articles for the LIMOC log, QST, QTX, or whatever. Have you planned a series of articles describing the advantages and disadvantages and methods of operation of the dinosaur repeater? I think you should. Consider that. K6DPZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
HURIWK6DPC. Yeah, I have considered putting all the documentation together and doing a story on it. It's just I haven't had a chance to yet, and I want to run the machine a little longer to make sure it has no snags. But as I said, Dick, all IMARC members are more than welcome to go on the machine and use it. That's why I wanted to come on tonight to mention. You know, a few IMARC members are already using it. But how do you treat it?
Okay, Gordon, repeat your question and or comment. You've got it, Gordon.
It's a comment, too, but let me ask a question first. What is the input frequency, what's the output frequency, and how does one trigger the repeater with the AM signal?
145.000 input, 146.00 output, carrier operated, no PL required, amplitude modulation gets reproduced by the repeater, no other requirements to start talking through it. It's located on a 130-foot tower near the, I think you said Verrazano. I can't read my own writing. It's in New York City. Over to you, Alan. Here we go. Gordon, W2TTT, mobile, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, so 145.000 is the input. And yeah, I mean, you're potential hertz from the packet, but that's probably okay given the size of the signals and the amount of users. But, you know, I do question whether or not that makes sense as far as, you know, being, if you will, should we say, thoughtful of the packet community. Having said that, I think 146.000 is the limit of our repeater subband. I don't think we're allowed to have emissions below 146 for repeaters. I think repeaters are limited to 144.5 to 145.5 and 146 to 148 on 2 meters. So if he's right on the line of 146, 000, then I don't think it meets regulatory muster. So just something to think about. Far be it from me to play radio police, but I gave up the presidency of TSARC to Chuck Motes, who was the stealth president of the Connecticut Spectrum Management Association, which was just another ridiculous task. And that's why we have 3 coordination bodies in the 30-mile circle here in Metro New York, MetroCorp, you know, UNIREPCO, and now CSMA. So none of this stuff gets repeat coordination protection because the old boy FM network. Try D-Star if you want to see how much fun it is to try to get coordinated. But anyway, end of rant. Good luck. It sounds like a fun project one way or the other. Back to you, Dick. W2TTT.
K6DPC, would like to throw a comment in, Dick.
Gordon, you made it sound like regulatory violation. I doubt it. To my knowledge, the frequencies that we use for transmit, receive, repeater, the various modes and whatever, are a gentleman's agreement of ham radio operators on the 2-meter band. To my knowledge, this is not FCC law. On top of that, if a person is smart enough to use only 6 kilohertz of bandwidth, plus or minus 3 kilohertz of audio, on an AM transmitter, where occasionally there is a packet signal on 145.100, 145.010, 10 kilohertz away, and if you're only using plus or minus 3 kilohertz, I think the chances of that occasional interference are fairly minor. And when it comes to transmitting on 146, even if it is a crime, I think it's a victimless crime. But I think all of these frequency allocations are a gentleman's agreement, and I don't think there's a real problem here. But Hal's going to bring us up to speed on that one. K6DPZ, K2RIW in the TechNet. K2RIW
in TechNet, K6DPC. Yeah, basically, I want to try and get this coordinated through the coordinating group. There's no question on that. As far as interfering, I've checked these frequencies. There was no activity for a good period of time, and I have the capabilities to monitor these frequencies because I have a lot of different equipment that has capabilities to do this. Nobody else has put up an AM repeater. This is an open repeater. I'm also going to get involved, if I can, with RACES and Homeland Security, and let them know they're welcome to use it also. And to say that, you know, it's a violation or something like this, if it creates a problem, I'll address the problem. But I think it's a concept that has to be done. Guys are interested in it. There's activity. And why don't we just play it out? That's the main thing I can say, Dick. Thanks for taking my defense on. I appreciate it.
Okay, good.
Just saying is check the rules.
Well, Gordon, briefly, what rules do you think are being violated? Is it a gentleman's agreement? If it's a crime, who's the victim of the crime? And I don't think the FCC law sets exact mega cycles. Gordon first, and then Eric in that order. Gordon, go ahead.
Well, last I looked, and you can check the rules, the regulations, I believe repeater outputs, by definition, have to be wholly within the spectrum of 146 to 148, and 144.5 to 145.5. Period. Now, inputs is a different matter. Yeah, I understand that. And I understand what Al's trying to do, and it's fine by me. I mean, I'm applauding the effort. But and I agree with your technical assessment about the input issue. But I don't think that that having it on having the output at, right on the dot of 146.0 it meets regulatory muster. But all I'm asking is that you suggesting to you, I'm not asking you to do anything, I'm suggesting that you might want to check the rules, check our rules on it. It's not a gentleman's agreement that I'm referring to. I wouldn't worry about that. Gentleman's agreement applies to things like what's going on 145.000. I get that, and that's fine. But, and you're probably going to be fine technically with that. But I'm just saying that I think there's an issue with the 146 frequency. I just want to, you don't want to get a notice from the FCC when you're trying to do something cool. And you really don't want to ask the coordinators to coordinate you on something that doesn't meet regulatory muster. Forget coordination issues. Because, you know, they'll have a whole set of fun with that. But, you know, my view of MetroCorp is suspect at best. So I feel your pain there. Anyway, back to you, Dick. KTRW and that W2CPJ.
N2MB. Okay, we'll go to Eric and then Barry in that order. KE2EJ, KQRIW in the tech net.
KQRIW, KE2EJ. Yeah, a couple of things, actually. There are as far as the FCC is concerned, they generally follow the band plans laid out nationally by the AWRL and also individually by the local repeater coordinating group. But as far as like the national plan goes, okay, 144.9 to 145.1 is considered to be weak signal in the FM simplex. The fact that it's listed as FM simplex really shouldn't be an issue. 9.6 that is used for APRS, there's a little bit of, you could be banging into it next door, but, you know, as long as the originating station keeps their bandwidth in the proper neighborhood, it should be fine. The other thing to watch out for, of course, is the space communication band plans, because the satellites that go above have a tendency to listen to everything that's within their bandpass. So, NASA subband is actually from 145.8 to 146. So, the 146 is sort of like a gray area in terms of, you know, satellites that are going overhead, but generally that's where it cuts off. So, the fact that it's double-sided band AM will actually bring it into the NASA subband, which, you know, some people may have a question about. Other than that, I mean, you know, simply, if you go to, according to the AWRL band plan, it's broken up into, you know, a whole bunch of things, where it's that if Al is going to do a linear translator, a linear translator would really be from 144.5 to 144.6, which is also part of the a new space subband, but, you know, it's considered to be linear translator inputs, linear translator outputs really are...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
We only lost a couple of seconds at the end, but the final comments that Eric made was he doesn't think we're going to have a problem. Barry, into Moonbound, what's your feeling on all of the above? Haven't heard from you in quite some time, and like an update from you when you get a chance. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, real good. Yeah, actually, tonight would be a good night for an update. I'm going to be running out of here in about 10 seconds. However, I just wanted to make note that I don't see anything in the FCC rules pertaining to where Hal could put his transmitter. There are some amateur agreements, but they're not, they wouldn't be violating any FCC rules. And the other thing is that I have played around putting sideband into Hal's repeater, and you can do it. If you offset your receiver, I think about a KC, put it on sideband, about a KC offset, and then you have to get rid of that horrible 1,000 cycle tone, which you can, with all these DSP radios. I did it, and it works. It's kind of interesting. Over to you, Dick, and 2MD.
That was you, Doug. You're much further off frequency now and almost uncopyable. Not sure of whether or not that was W2SAY. So, Hal, are you familiar with the fact that with DSP you can put single sideband through your repeater? K16PZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K16PZ. Yeah, Barry had to try an experiment. It is not a translator, Dick. It is a receiver. It's receiving AM, demodulating it, and driving a transmitter with the AM. So it's not a linear translator where it's going to pass a band of frequencies. I wanted to make that very clear. And the thing is, hopefully, you know, I'm not looking to have any interference problems or anything like that. I just figured this would be something that everybody could use. It's not a private machine. Anybody is welcome with AM equipment. Which AM equipment is becoming very archaic. And, you know, it's a different approach. And being it's not a 600 KC repeater split, it's not FM, I would say if it doesn't hurt anybody, fine. If there's problems, I'll address those problems when they come in.
KC2, QIQ.
Glenn recognized. Was there another person in there? You got it, Glenn.
Yeah, just a quick comment about the compatibility of AM and packet digital. I've had, you know, listened on packet digital and did quite a bit with a lot of the digital modes. And what's interesting is that you can have sometimes people on sideband, AM, FM, literally, right, you can, if you tune your receiver in those modes, you can hear them. And then if you go into the packet mode just underneath it, the packet passes through just fine. So I think Hal really doesn't have much to worry about, because I think in most cases, the compatibility of the two modes, even sharing the same frequency, will probably work 90% of the time. KC2, QIQ.
Also, when it comes to the exactness of this band plan as to what is allowed at 146.000 megahertz, I see the possibility that Hal could move it up 3 kilohertz on the transmitter to get away from that problem. Leave the input alone, leave the output 6 KC higher.
Yeah, the lower part hits the space band, which could be a problem.
So if he moved up 3 kilohertz on the output frequency, would he now be, from all you can tell, Eric, essentially 100% legal?
Now, here's the problem. At 146.01, his repeater inputs for FM. So, although in this neighborhood, I don't think there's any 6.1 repeaters, so... And then we have 6.4, so he's probably okay.
W2TTT, it's in West Patterson, facing New York City.
Okay, so I think you're saying there is one on 146.1, 146.100, and I'm talking about moving up 146.003. Would that really be a problem? Over to you, Gordon.
Okay, the repeater is the Land Rover's repeater. It's in West Patterson. It's on top of, or thereabouts. It faces New York City. It's on 146.61. so its input is 145.01. So, yeah, if you move to 3 kilohertz up, my guess is you'd probably be okay. They're a PL repeater. I doubt if you capture it. That probably makes good sense. Now, just for everybody's benefit, I realize that there's a lot of sensitivity about the 145... What is it? No. Never mind. I was thinking... There are packet frequencies, which are also sometimes called FM frequencies or whatever. 144.91, 93, 95, 97, and 99, 145.01, 03, 05, 07, 09. Now, given some of the decline in packet operation, that they're not as busy as they used to be. But certainly 145.01 is, so do keep that in mind. But, that having been said, I think for all the reasons you said, Dick, before, things are moved 3 kilohertz up, so it would be 145.003 and 146.003. I think you're on spot on, and I think that'll be fine.
Yeah, I don't think Hal's got to move right now, but if there is a complaint, that's a possible remedy as I see it. Once again, Mel, we've gone beyond the 9 o'clock when I know we're supposed to go over to your mailbag. K2K, I'm going to hold off on Paul, who's on our list at the S2N. K2KEY, K2RIW, go right ahead, Mel.
I'm Roger, this is K2KEY. I don't know really if we got the young audience left, Dick. All right, well, maybe a few minutes. All right, I'm going to take just a short one. I've got several. Believe it or not, I'm getting a lot of them that remember when we discussed telescope and astronomy and things like that. A lot of these ham clubs, of these young ham clubs in these schools are also incorporating the some astronomy into the course, Dick. So I'm getting some questions, and I don't know really how to answer them because I'm not really... I have a telescope. I like looking, but I'm not going to be an aficionado, as they say, of astronomy to answer some detailed questions over.
Yeah, I was for a number of years a fairly inactive member of ASLI, Astronomical Society of Long Island, a very enthusiastic group that meets every single Wednesday night, most of the time now at the Vanderbilt Planetarium in Centerport, Long Island. And there's a New York City group, another group at Rockland County, Bergen County. There's lots and lots of astronomy groups. Astronomy, as I see it, Mel, is one of the most pure sciences in the world. And a little bit difficult to run an astronomy serious operation with all the extra man-made lighting you've got in New York City. So why don't you fire at least one of those questions at us, Mel, because I also get some very favorable mail whenever we have the subject of astronomy. Obvious by all the screaming and hollering that took place when for a while NASA was threatening not to repair Hubble. Boy, there's a significant number of Hubble huggers out there. So lots and lots of people are kind of a silent majority who've got a real first love of astronomy. So give us at least one or two of those questions, Mel. Go ahead.
Okay, this is K2KEY again. Yeah, I'm Roger. As far as the Hubble Space Telescope and what went up the screen for get it fixed. We need it. One of these questions, let's see, on something straightforward, as I say, getting late. Okay, a spotting scope, is there a need for what power? I don't know. I'm not sure I understand it. A spotting scope, does it have a lens and what power, Dick? Am I getting this correct? Over.
There's a little bit of ambiguity here. There are two separate items that are called spotting scope. There's a kind of a tripod-mounted medium-power telescope that people will use for terrestrial observing of birds and animals. And there's a version of those called spotting scope, and if you go to the usual catalog. All of a sudden, I can't think of the name of the catalog that I've seen most.
Orion.
Orion. Thank goodness. The Orion catalog. And you just Google the word Orion, you'll see a beautiful catalog that will mail to you. Lots and lots of binoculars and telescopes in there of all various kinds. So there's a whole series of medium power, highly transportable scopes called spotting scopes. There's another thing that is on the side of a higher power telescope. Say, for instance, my 8-inch diameter Schmidt Cassegrain made by Celestron. There is a very small telescope alongside of it at much, much lower power, but it's got a set of crosshairs in it. When you're using a big telescope at high power, the good news is you've got fantastic light gathering power and lots of resolution. That's the good news. Let me drop. The bad news is that by definition with its high power, it's got an extremely small field of view, a fraction of a degree in many circumstances. And so you may set up your setting circles, your azimuth and elevation, your right ascension, your declination, all of the knobs on the tripod of the oscilloscope. Even if you've got those properly aligned, it may take you an awful long time to find that particular star at a known location at that hour of the day. And with that small telescope that's alongside of your main telescope, that's got a much wider field of view. Not going to give you the high-resolution picture, but it's looking at 10 or 100 times more area of the sky all at once. And if you take the star that you are interested in and put it in the middle of the crosshairs, then when things are properly aligned, it'll appear close to the center of the eyepiece of the high-power telescope. So you've got two separate eyepieces on a high-power telescope. And so that one alongside, I call it a spotting scope. Maybe it's got a bunch of other names. So maybe that helps a little bit, Mel. It doesn't have to be a very big piece of glass. It doesn't have to have high power. It's got a very different operation. It's just locating, not for use for real viewing, if you know what I mean. K2KEY, K2RIW on the tech man.
Okay, because I have a telescope. I went out tonight. Looked like Jupiter was pretty clear tonight. You know, not too often we get conditions like that here in Brooklyn. So I went out and took a look at Jupiter, and I could actually see the moon pretty well on my, which is not really a telescope, I assume, anywhere in the category you just mentioned that you have. This is a neat telescope that I have. It's a, it's 3 inches in the lens in there. It's a regular telescope, you know, front lens in there, and it has the power. It has a 25 millimeter, and it has a 75 millimeter. You know, you put in different eyepieces, but the scope, the so-called spotting scope on the side I was going to talk about, is basically just like a little piece thing, a little hole with another piece on it, you know, and you just like, looks like nothing, just like a hole, a piece of metal over.
So when I removed the spotting scope from my Schmidt Cassegrain 8-inch diameter thing, I've got a circular piece of metal where it mounts. And yes, there are telescopes where the alignment tool on the side is somewhat like the sighting of a gun. But almost all of the telescopes of medium quality will have a very, very small telescope mounted parallel to the main telescope. Your 3-inch refractor, believe it or not, you're using some discouraging words as if to say it's not very much of a telescope. What you've got there is a hell of a lot more than what Galileo Galilei had way back in 1612, was it, I think, when he was looking at Jupiter. And he suddenly realized that there is a heavenly body which has separate objects going around it. He was looking at Jupiter's moon. And my goodness, did that set off a revolution. A revolution, whatever. That was one great big step in the world of astronomy when he suddenly realized that things go around, and he suddenly realized that the Ptolemaic system is much too complicated to try to explain what's going on in our universe. not the the alternate technique. All of a sudden, I can't think of the guy's name. Say again?
Copernicus was basically, they followed the belief of Copernicus, I believe, the previous over.
Sounds like, right. I know that. Now, when it comes to various ways of explaining the sky, solar-centered versus an Earth-centered system, lots of people want to say that the Earth-centered system is wrong and the solar-centered system is right. And each of these are a model. Yes, the Earth-centered system, you end up with these very complicated epicycles and whatever. It's much more difficult to predict where everything's going to be. But it is a model that does work. It's not dead wrong. It's just nowhere near as efficient a model as the solar-centered model is for this particular solar system. And you can carry that to the next step as far as the way our sun operates within this particular galaxy, and the way our galaxy works within our particular local galactic group, and the way that works with reference to the rest of the universe, and whether or not there's more than one universe. And I think there is.
You thinking of Kepler?
Yeah, the Keplerian system? Yes, I think that's it. Versus Ptolemy. That sounds right. Keplerian. So, the solar-centered system of assessment of where all the things are, and the elliptical orbits.
That's Kepler.
You got it. Kepler's first, second, and third law. Turns out that no orbit around a other heavenly body is a perfect circle, with rare exception. Everything is an ellipse. And when it comes to things that are in orbit, boy, you'll be amazed how complicated that is, even though it looks simple. If your astronaut is floating in front of your space station, and he's a mile away, and you're doing the maneuvering, and you want to simply blast the rocket backwards away from him, so to speak, to speed up to go and go capture him. Depending on how fast you're doing it, it's nowhere near as easy as you think. Sometimes you've got to do the extreme opposite, but we won't get into that. I wonder if you've got another telescope question there, or astronomy question, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Comment.
Go ahead, John.
Mel, if you're going to make any recommendations on a spotting scope, if they're doing heavenly observations, astronomical, not terrestrial, they won't be using a Barlow lens. 10 power is plenty, and they don't even have to worry about eye relief with a spotting scope. So relatively cheap spotting scopes can be used with excellent telescopes, and they'll be very successful.
And by the way, I know of somebody who bought a real nice telescope that had no spotting scope on it. And with a little bit of machining work and drilling some holes in the side and whatever, he added his own very low power telescope, acting as a spotting scope, and it worked like a charm. So just like we amateurs continuously are modifying our transmitters and receivers, there's nothing illegal, immoral, or fattening about modifying your telescope. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yes, this is K2KEY. Yeah, I did mention that. I have seen that on a number of these telescopes, like you say, similar to the one that I have, the Polaris, the Mead Polaris. This one at least is, you know, something to it. It's got a nice tripod. It's got a place to keep the extra lenses and everything. It's got a sort of a... But the spotting scope don't look like very much of anything. Nothing elaborate there. I don't think it has even any magnification. In fact, this is supposed to be the deluxe version of it. They have another one that looks exactly the same. In fact, it has the same supposedly 700 millimeter length and whatever the heck it has on there. Basically the same, except what their spotting scope looks like. You know, you're cheaping it down. The tripod's a little cheaper, things like that. And the spotting scope actually consists of a little piece of L metal coming off the tube with a hole in it, a small hole, and then another one up front, another piece that looks like L metal with a little larger hole, Dick, and I guess that's the spotting scope over.
Yeah, that sounds like a gunsight almost. By the way, any of these telescopes that you're talking about now, your 3-incher, a set of binoculars,
or even bigger. If you Google the word Baader, B-A-A-D-E-R, it's a company in Germany, and there's a whole lot of American representatives that will sell the stuff to you. Baader film is something that's got a grade 5, grade is not the word, level 5. It's got a 10 to the 5 filter factor to it. When you look at this film, it looks like a Mylar with silver writing in it. But it's a very precision-made film, and by making a simple cardboard tube that has the right diameter of the center of the front of your telescope, you can easily mount this beta film on your telescope and then do direct solar observation with your binoculars, with your telescope. You've got to do some care here. Make sure that the film doesn't fall off. Otherwise, the sun goes roaring through that telescope and burns a hole in your eye, if you know what I mean. But when you start looking at the sun with even mediocre power telescopes, with the right kind of a filter on the front of the telescope, not at the eyepiece. There's a whole lot of reasons why you don't do that. Because you're gathering too much power and you can't dissipate it correctly. But if you start it, let me drop. At the front. And you make a solar filter, a solar attenuator. And they call it level 5, grade 5. It really means 10 to the 5 power. That really means a 100,000 to 1 ratio. It cuts down the amount of illumination by 100,000 to 1. And you aim your telescope at the sun, and you look at those sunspots. And you watch those sunspots move day to day, change, get bigger and smaller. And you see that from your own backyard. That is a fun thing to see. And in that particular case, the spotting scope is very helpful, but you got to be careful. The spotting scope, in that case, you don't look through the spotting scope unless you put film in front of it also. You got to worry about the fact that the sun shining through your spotting scope, if it has any magnification to it, would be putting total solar power onto your crosshairs. And your crosshairs in a telescope, in some cases, are two little pieces of spider web, and you can burn them up pretty fast. So you might want to put some tinfoil over the spotting scope to protect it when you're doing solar observation. And when it comes to aiming your telescope at the sun, one very simple thing to do is to simply look at the shadow on the ground. When you make the diameter of your telescope, the minimum size diameter of shadow on the ground, it is essentially aimed at the sun. And after that, you put in your lowest power eyepiece, zoom it back and forth, up and down, center it on the sun, then go to your high-powered ISP eyepiece. And as I said, looking at the sun is an awful lot of fun. A lot of people don't know about that. So we'll look up this Baader film. It is better by a long shot than many of the solar filters you can buy from the Orion catalog.
Yeah, you can use a hyperlite too.
Yeah, that takes a look. For a guy with a Newtonian scope, yes. For a guy with a refractor, no. I don't think there's a good way of using a Herschel wedge with a refractor. I'll turn it back to you, Eric, for a comment on that one.
Oh, by the way, the spotting scopes are usually reading in arcseconds. On the scopes that I built, I had both 10 and 20 arcsecond spotting scopes with the calibrated gradcules. So if you calibrate them right, they're actually quite accurate. Herschel wedge is a good device. I'm only a Newtonian guy. I'm not even a Cassegrainian guy. You remember I told you that I've ground my own mirrors. I did a 16-inch with a focal length of 96 inches, which means you need a ladder in order to look at the damn thing. But Herschel wedge can be fun. Even with a Herschel wedge, you might want to go the projection route because there's still a lot of light. You'd want, you know, an ND20 even after Herschel wedge just to be sure that you're not damaging your eyes in any form. The Herschel wedge will transmit most of the light energy out in the direction that you don't want it, and you're only left with like 0.5 to 0.2% of the light energy coming through the eyepiece, through the ocular. But I still recommend that you use a UV block in the ocular. And all the infrared energy spits out through the Herschel wedge. So it is a good way to work with a Newtonian, but you really have to be careful when you're doing that stuff.
Run that by one more time, Eric. What was the diameter of the biggest scope, the biggest mirror that you ground where you had to stand on a ladder? I think you said 60 inches. I'm having a lot of trouble believing that. Over to you, Eric.
No, I did not say 60. I said 1.